And then there's the little T traumas, which I sort of see as like these little paper cuts every day, these moments of just feeling overwhelmed, of, you know, having a child who's screaming in your face and you're out in public and the noticing the person looking at you, and these little paper cuts that we can experience throughout the day that like our brain's trying to process and heal. But if the paper cuts keep happening throughout all these just sort of daily activities, at some point your system's going to get overwhelmed by that. And you, the listener, whether we're going to call this PTSD, big T trauma, little T trauma, if you find yourself feeling triggered by your child's behavior, you're so not alone and you deserve support.
Welcome to the SensoryWise Solutions podcast for parents, where parents can get real, actionable strategies to support kids with sensory processing disorder. I'm Laura, OT and mom to Liliana, a sensory sensitive kid who inherited my anxiety and my love for all things Disney. Consider me your new OT mom bestie. I know my stuff, but I also know what it's really like in the trenches of parenting a child with sensory processing disorder.
Okay, mom, enough about me. Let's start the podcast.
Hey parents, this one is for the mamas, the dads, really any caregiver who has experienced trauma or maybe wonders if they are currently experiencing signs or symptoms that are consistent with PTSD. In this episode, I'm interviewing the talented and brilliant Dr. Cassidy Freitas. I was on her podcast last year talking about sensory sensitivity, and since then we've been Insta friends, we become colleagues online, and we definitely share the same For You page on TikTok. If you follow her, you know what I mean. But if you don't know her, Dr. Cassidy Freitas is a licensed marriage and family therapist offering virtual supportive therapy to parents in California. She's a mom to three and hosts the top-rated parenting podcast called Holding Space. She has a special place in her heart for sensory-sensitive kiddos as she has two of her own and she is married to a grown-up one too. You can learn more about her therapy practice at www.drcassidymft.com. And you can connect with her on her Instagram at Dr. Cassidy. That's just DrCassidy. All of these links will be in the show notes. And you can also find a link there for her podcast called Holding Space. Stay tuned to hear some gems that she shares about how trauma can show up in parenthood and some of the best practices to support yourself in those moments of stress. Oh, and one final note, I didn't realize until after the recording that my actual podcast mic was not on. It was just my AirPods mic. So apologies for the sound quality. I hope you can still hear what I'm saying. Hello, Dr. Cassidy. It's
Hello.
So good to have you here. I'm so excited finally to have you now on the podcast. I was on your podcast like
you
a year
were.
Ago.
You were. And we're always chatting back and forth on the Instagram. And so just getting a chance to like see your beautiful face and talk in real time. I'm so excited to be here. So thank you so much for having me on.
I love that Instagram has kind of been this. I talk about this all the time with my husband that I feel like Instagram is this like new, like mom, like high school where we have like little pockets of friends and we're meeting friends. And I feel like we all have, cause we all like hang out in the same circles, all the parenting space. And so you're definitely one of my friends, my Instagram high school friends. And I just can't, I love talking with you and I'm so excited for this episode today. A lot of people are waiting for this. And so it's really, really an honor to have you here to talk about this topic, which is experiencing PTSD or what feels like PTSD in motherhood. And so I want to explain a little bit about how this came up and then I'll let you take it away and explain maybe the background behind it or see if there's any light to what my experience was. So recently on Instagram, a couple months ago now, I was sharing how some of my daughter's like
escalations into meltdown, not even full meltdown yet. There's certain things she says, the way her body moves, the tone of her voice, that make me sort of have flashbacks to a time when we had a really, really dark time in our journey together, when she was like two to three, yeah. When meltdowns, like 90 minute long meltdowns multiple times a day. My husband and I were quarantined before pandemic was a thing, because we just couldn't leave the house. We couldn't get out of the house. It was just so hard with her. So there's certain sounds she makes, or times when she's about to melt down, or even seeing a picture from that time where, instead of like, oh, how cute she is, the first thing I think of is like, oh, that was such a hard time. Like, I can't see anything else. And so I was asking people, and I'm like, does anyone else experience flashbacks or feelings of PTSD as a mom, maybe to a neurodivergent kid, or just a child who has had really maybe a complex medical history or big meltdowns? And I got a lot of responses saying they do. And then a lot of people saying that it wasn't considered PTSD. And there was this kind of respectful debate, but there was this debate on if you can have PTSD stemming from parenting a child with either complex medical needs, or a child who is neurodivergent. And so I was like, this is a great topic. I don't have the answer. I certainly feel like whatever it's a response to some traumatic event or time in my life, whether or not that's considered quote PTSD, I'm not sure. And also there was this idea of that sort of taking away from people who have PTSD from some other big event in their life, loss of a loved one, or experiencing violence, and all of those things. So what are your thoughts on this topic?
Such a great question. And when you first shared this question with me, I really appreciated the kind of reflecting that it brought to me, like in terms of, okay, we're talking here about trauma. There's this diagnosis that we're throwing around, PTSD. We're talking about the experience of parenting, you know, a child with complex medical history or conditions, or a neurodivergent child. And where do the pieces fall? So I love this question. And let's start off by looking at this diagnosis of PTSD. So PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, comes from, here in the US, the DSM-5. And criteria for PTSD, let's look at that. What does that include? The first piece is that there's either going to be direct or indirect exposure to some sort of traumatic event. And then following that traumatic event, symptoms that typically show up in four different categories. So intrusion, which looks like intrusive thoughts, flashbacks, maybe dreams, nightmares of the traumatic event. There can also be physical reactions that people experience when they're reminded of the event. There's also going to be another category is avoidance. So avoiding certain places or certain situations that might elicit memories of that event. You're also potentially going to experience a negative emotional state, such as shame, anger, fear. There's going to be hypervigilance or irritability, potentially. You might also find that you have difficulty sleeping for all of the above reasons. Now, when you look at that definition of that diagnosis, there's the main piece here. I mean, I think when you look at a lot of those symptoms, a lot of things that you described fit into that, right? When you may have had intrusive thoughts or flashbacks, or found yourself whenever there was a stimulus that reminded you of that certain season of your life with her, that you'd find that these feelings would come up, maybe of shame, or of, anger or anxiety. Mm-hmm. Maybe you find yourself avoiding situations that would remind you of that time in your life or of that season. Maybe you had, found yourself having a hard time sleeping. A lot of those symptoms, I think that you could, from what you shared, you could probably relate to. Now, in terms of like the actual like DSM diagnosis of PTSD, the first piece here of direct or indirect exposure to a traumatic event. Now, absolutely can there be in someone's situation a specific event that occurred that when they that then leads them to experience diagnosable post-traumatic stress disorder, right? And what might that look like as a parent to a neurodivergent child? There could have been a situation during a meltdown or something that happened at school that when they got the call or when when they were out and about, something happened that was very traumatizing for them. Learning about the child's diagnosis and events that happened around that period of time, absolutely can that be the case, right? What I think is, and this kind of aligns more with just like my approach therapeutically as well, and how I conceptualize, you know, the clients that I work with and the families that I work with. Having a name for something like PTSD can be really helpful in some cases because it gives someone a name to understand their experience. And, you know, for insurance purposes, like, you know, the diagnosis can help you get services, like, you know, all the same things that like I actually struggled with when two of my children were diagnosed with sensory processing disorder. I really struggled with the label, the diagnosis, but I also found comfort in a name for what we were experiencing, and it helped us access resources. I think though, you know, with that definition of PTSD, can somebody connected to parenting have a traumatic experience in motherhood with their child that would then align with that, the box of PTSD for sure. But what I think is even more important is to talk about trauma, because you can experience, there's actually another quote unquote label out there called complex PTSD, which isn't a diagnosis in the DSM necessarily, but it looks more at the experience of someone who's had maybe prolonged trauma, right? Mm-hmm. And so situations where over and over and over again, they experienced, you know, something that was traumatic. And a lot of times what you'll see there is folks who had, you know, a history of childhood abuse, you know, they were abused as children, they were neglected, and they experienced this prolonged trauma and then complex PTSD, right? It wasn't like this one event, like, an assault or a car accident, but there was this prolonged experience of mm-hmm.
That's what it kind of feels like for me in my specific case, that one like 6 to 9 months of, I just call it darkness. That was like my dark time, like for
absolutely.
My family.
Yeah. And here's another thing, another layer to add to this, you know, is that when we become parents, whether your child is neurodivergent or not, like it can trigger old stuff. Like nothing has brought forward like my own inner child stuff, old cobwebs of past experiences that I hadn't really worked through than becoming a parent. And then having two children with sensory processing disorder and the specific challenges of that have really brought forth old stuff for me too. So it's also very likely that someone could have had a traumatic event in their past, right? Mm. And then all of a sudden,
unrelated to motherhood is what you're saying.
Unrelated,
like just a whole to motherhood. Different thing. Okay,
right. Like there was something else that happened. A car accident,
like you said, or a death of a best friend, or something like that, right?
Of a loved one, a car accident, an assault, something that you witnessed. And what our brain does when we experience trauma is it tends to hold, you know, store the memory of that experience in a pretty specific way. It's like, oh, that was intense. And my job as the brain of this human is to keep you safe and protect you from these threats. And so I'm going to store this memory in a way that really keeps us on high alert for anything that ever remotely resembles this experience. And so our brain tends to store memories in like images, cognitions, or, you know, thoughts, emotions, and physical sensations. And so maybe you've experienced something in your life where you felt powerless, or you felt like there was something wrong with you, or you felt unsafe. And you know, when you had that experience, you felt there was like sensations, you know, there's emotions like shame connected to it, or fear, or overwhelm. Or you found yourself physically having, you know, like whenever you think about it, like stomach aches or tightness in your chest, like different ways in which your brain has kind of stored that memory, you know,
context, right? A specific context that relates to, the sensations and things related to it. Yes.
But then let's say you become a parent and you have a child who responds to the world around them right away, very quickly, in the reptilian part of their brain, fight or flight, and everyday activities tends to trigger that for them. And your child has these major, these huge meltdowns, and you're out in public, and you're just trying to literally like do everyday things, and everything is met with these challenges and this difficulty. And what might you be feeling in that moment? Powerless. Right. And if your brain is like, I feel powerless in this moment, I feel overwhelmed in this moment, there's really loud noises happening in this moment, I feel whatever the case, I feel ashamed in this moment, I feel like people are watching me in this moment, it's very possible that like things that happen in that moment, your brain is like, oh, this feels familiar. Remember that time that this really scary, traumatic thing happened? Okay. Like, and then it'll your brain will connect those experiences together. And then you might find yourself responding to that child's, you know, meltdown in that moment or that situation in a response that's going to look like a traumatic response. You're going to feel triggered. And so it can be related to past stuff, but it could also be just deeply connected to other experiences, prolonged experiences that you've had with your child, having meltdowns, having, you know, screaming on the ground in public, like feeling like with a minute that child starts to make that face or make that sound, you're reminded of these other experiences that your brain has processed in a way that is like, that was intense, that felt threatening. I need to keep us safe. So I'm going to become very hypervigilant for looking for other threats. And now whenever you see those little reminders of those threats, it might take you right back to that place of like a trauma response, a fight, flight, you know, freeze response.
That's so fascinating because I never thought that it could have like an indirect link to something for someone else who had like some other trauma that happened forever ago. But that makes so much sense. And I know that people listening right now, some questions were asked about people who had traumas from before becoming motherhood and also being triggered by their children crying, which makes sense. But I want to go back to what you were talking about and how, you know, both Dr. Cassidy and I are Good Inside contributors for Dr. Becky's Good Inside membership. I love seeing you around there. Shout out to Dr. Becky. But we always talk about how like labels, like you said, can be helpful for some things, but also very rigid and gets us stuck and narrow-minded and looking in a certain direction.
Yeah.
But I love the reason why, like, and how you mentioned it can be helpful for us to put a name to our experience, and why I feel like so many moms are gravitating towards this and looking for a reason is because, you know, in 2022, as a millennial parent dealing with everything we did, especially mothers, when we're constantly painted as either too dramatic, not paying attention enough to our kids' things, paying attention to too many different things, burnt out, like all the different things that come with being a mom, that it's so noisy, both like in our physical environment, but in our social media environment and in our friendships and in our networks, and trying to make sense of our own individual experiences, but yet always being bombarded by conflicting information and trying to make sense of it. And I think there's a sense of like of almost relief or like just validation that like, oh, it's not me. It's not me not being able to handle being a mom. It is something going on in my brain. It is something that I can't control. And I feel like some moms gravitate towards that and finding that peace with like, oh, there's something that explains what I'm going through, which I feel like a lot of people experience with all different diagnoses, but specifically in the context of motherhood in 2022, it can be a relief to know that this isn't just me being burnt out. This isn't just me not being able to handle daily life. This is trauma from something else.
Yeah, I think that it can be really helpful to just, because I think, yeah, there can be those moments where you're like, this feels so intense. And I feel like I'm really struggling with this experience. And you might find yourself falling into a spiral of like shame. Like there's must be something wrong with me that I can't handle this, right? Yes. And I think it can be very empowering to then have someone name for you, right? Like there's actually a name for this experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that it can go both ways, right? It can go to the way of like, oh, look, here's proof that there is something wrong with me. Like I have, you know, I've definitely seen folks go that direction too. And gosh, when we first got our child's diagnosis for sensory processing disorder, I went to a lot of places of like shame that we didn't do something sooner, fear about how this label was going to follow my child and fear for their future and just overwhelm. And it was actually a colleague of mine who, we were recording a podcast together, but it wasn't during the recording. She was at my house and, it was after we recorded and I kind of broke down and I was, you know, sharing this with her. And she said to me, I'll never forget it. She said, you know, because she has a neurodivergent child and husband as well. And she said, you know what, this is how I really want to support you in looking at this. You get to know your child that much more intimately now. And you do have agency and power in the role that this label has in your child's life. And as their parent, you've got a lot of agency and power in that way, in terms of how you advocate for them and how you talk to them about this part of them, right? And this label. And when she said that, it really shifted something inside for me. I definitely broke down in tears because it was a really vulnerable.
Beautiful. And that's a really great way to think about it, especially in that moment.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that the same thing can go for us, right? Like if the listener is like, I'm struggling, like I am feeling super triggered by my child's like behavior or like noises that they make, or I feel like I am struggling, right? And I am avoiding situations. I am feeling like hypervigilant. I want the listener right now to take a moment to pause and to say, you know what, like it's very, very possible that like being a parent to a child that navigates the world and experiences the world in the way in which my child does and trying to support that child is going to feel hard and can be traumatic, right? There's capital T traumas, right? Which we would, you know, maybe look at as like, yeah, the car accidents, the assaults, that one big event that happened. And then there's the little T traumas, which I sort of see as like these little paper cuts every day, these moments of just feeling overwhelmed, of, you know, having a child who's screaming in your face and you're out in public and noticing the person looking at you, and these little paper cuts that we can experience throughout the day that like our brain's trying to process and heal. But if the paper cuts keep happening throughout all these just sort of daily activities, at some point your system's going to get overwhelmed by that. And you, the listener, whether we're going to call this PTSD, big T trauma, little T trauma, if you find yourself feeling triggered by your child's behavior, you're so not alone and you deserve support and you can find, you can process and heal and feel better and not find yourself feeling like the trigger, the experiences, the trauma is running your life. That's totally possible. And I think that it's so easy to get caught up in like the linguistics of like, is it this or is it that? And as we've discussed, it's powerful to have a label for things. But if you're struggling, regardless of if it's a diagnosable thing or not, trauma is absolutely something that can be experienced in being a parent to a neurodivergent child. And both for your child's sake and for your sake, you deserve support.
I love that message. And that's the same message I give to parents when they're asking, my child is having a hard time with clothing, with this, like, when is it time to seek OT? And I have my technical answer, which is if, you know, daily life is impacted, all of that. But then at the end of it, I always say, if you need help, seek support, go consult with a professional and see whether or not your child qualifies for this diagnosis or this service. Get in the door, speak to a professional who is an expert in that area and see what tips they have for you. So in that, on that trajectory, can you share with us what there's in my head? I don't know all the different modalities and different types of intervention. I'm sure there's a ton of different styles, but what is kind of the gold standard for working with a parent who is experiencing, let's call it little T trauma from like the meltdowns and all of that from their kids? What kind of therapy or professional should we be looking for? And how do we get started with that?
Such a good question. And I've got to talk about EMDR in the context.
I keep hearing about this, but I've never looked into it or tried it, but I keep getting it. People are saying you should look into it. So tell me, please.
Yes. And there's definitely other approaches too. But let me chat a little bit about EMDR for a second. And so EMDR, here's what it stands for. And it's going to just probably sound woo-woo and even more confusing, but like, we'll get to why it's evidence-based and works and powerful. So it stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which I'm like, okay, like, yeah, that kind of gets to the like logistics, but like, I feel like it initially can sound scary or like intimidating.
It's better than what I thought. I thought EM standard for electromagnetic and I thought,
yeah, yeah. Like, yeah, electroconvulsive therapy.
Yeah,
though.
I'm like, no, that doesn't sound fun.
Yeah, so, okay, so basically what EMDR was is an evidence-based approach, and it's one of those things that, like, I knew the research is out there, like, evidence-based, it really works. And so when I was working with clients that had big T or little T trauma, who were coming in and were feeling blocked or experiencing triggers, right? Like something that was happening in their life. And now present day, they find themselves feeling triggered and it kind of takes them right back there, or they're having these like stress responses, or like avoidance or phobias or anxiety. If we were doing work with each other, but there was still this like these blocks popping up around, you know, some of these negative thoughts about themselves, or just like those physical sensations around the triggers were just like still really present for them, I would say, hey, why don't you try EMDR? I'm going to give you a referral. I want you to go give this a try and then come back. And they'd come back and it was like, so I could not deny the results that they were experiencing. And then, but that I was always like, that's like a little woo-woo though. I can't like, that's how I felt. I can't like picture myself putting my fingers in front of someone's eyes and like having them follow my fingers. And it's not just eye movement. There's other ways that EMDR.
Sounds like hypnosis almost, the way you're
describing it. Yeah, sounded like hypnosis. And so I was like, and I knew that it wasn't, but I just couldn't picture myself doing it clinically in my practice. And then I went and had it done on myself. I had a traumatic birth experience. And then, you know, later on down the line, I had a pregnancy loss and was finding myself in certain situations, feeling really triggered in situations where I felt like I, you know, felt powerless or felt like there was something wrong with me, with my body. And so I went and had EMDR done. And that is when I was like, oh, I am so sold. That was so powerful. What could have been accomplished probably in like 3 years of talk therapy was able to move. I felt I experienced really profound processing and healing in 3 months. And so then I went and did the training. So EMDR is one of the gold standards for trauma. Initially a lot of the research was looking at PTSD from, you know, that vets were experiencing from going to war. But hey, I think that, you know, while going to war and being a vet is absolutely its own experience, and the levels of stress and what you witness there, very different from being a parent to a neurodivergent child in so many profound ways. But also, I have had parents who are parents of a neurodivergent child or a child with, you know, serious medical conditions share with me that every day feels like a battleground, right? Like they feel like they're at battle within themselves and with their child, and it's their child. They don't want to be in this battle. They want to experience peace, safety, security, all the things that we fight for, you know, or that we want, you know, rather than war. And it can feel like that for them. So profound differences. I'm not saying that they are the same experiences, but some people will use that as a metaphor to describe how intense it is for them. So what EMDR does is it utilizes the process that happens in our brain naturally when we are processing things and storing our experiences, which is this bilateral stimulation during REM sleep, rapid eye movement. You know, when our eyes are kind of moving back and forth during sleep, that is this time during our sleep when our brain is like, okay, what happened today? All right, let's process that. Let's make some connections. Let's store these memories. And when we experience, though, really intense events or repetitive, prolonged, really intense events, our brain can get overloaded. And it's really hard for our brain to process and store those events and experiences in a way that isn't like at the forefront, a little guard looking for the threats all the time or just getting overloaded, right? So what EMDR does is through bilateral stimulation, either eye movement or tapping, tones, sounds. I do a lot of virtual therapy. And so for my clients, it would be a butterfly hug, arms across their chest, tapping their shoulders back and forth. What you do is through a structure of assessment and identifying the experiences that you want to process and the sort of connection link of experiences that are all kind of connected with each other through an assessment and really structured process to identify that, you kind of go into the brain by saying, hey, I'm going to have you bring to mind this memory, the image that comes to mind, because that's how we tend to store it, through image, cognition that comes to mind about yourself. So maybe, you know, I am powerless, I am broken, I am ashamed, I am unloved, there's something wrong with me. The negative words about yourself that you associate with this memory, the physical sensations and the emotions. I'm going to have you bring that to mind. And that's kind of like going into someone's brain and asking them to turn the lights on in the part of their brain that stores those memories. And then all the other memories that your brain has connected to it. So you go in, you open that up, and then you'll engage in the bilateral stimulation. So tapping or eye movement, which is activating your brain's natural process to process something and to store memories. And what's so cool is that your brain will take you where it needs to go first to kind of clear through things that need to be processed first before it gets to the next piece. So your brain will sometimes jump around. So someone will do eye movement or tapping for a period of time. We'll say, let's pause, take a breath. And what did you notice? And then the client just shares what they notice, where their brain went. And part of the therapist's job is to notice when someone gets blocked or they're looping around a certain memory. That's our role. But then we really just go back to, okay, I want you to just notice that and let's keep tapping. Because what's so cool about EMDR is it really supports and activates that person's natural healing. And so the insights, the conclusions, the awareness, the growth, the healing, it really comes from you and from within. And so all of a sudden a client's like, well, I remembered this, that I was focused on this, but all of a sudden I remember that this also happened or this is what I needed in that moment, you know, and I didn't have the power to get to access to express that need then, but now I can. So much of it comes from within them, and it's beautiful because I'm there to witness that. And I'm obviously there to support that. And I know the structure of, you know, opening up the EMDR and making sure that we're following the protocol, but so much of the healing comes from within the client. I've had several clients with children who are neurodivergent who come in because of, you know, the little T traumas, prolonged, like really intense triggering experiences that they've had, come in and will potentially initiate EMDR. And we'll discover that there's actually other stuff before becoming a parent that their brain kind of connects to the really intense experiences they're having with their child, and which kind of explains why these moments become that are that much more triggering for them. And as they begin to make these connections and these insights, and then the healing and processing that happens through EMDR, it can really impact, it can really impact their relationship with their child, their day-to-day functioning, their ability to feel like they have, when they find themselves being triggered, because, you know, we're human and like life's going to trigger us sometimes, that it's not, it doesn't take them away, that they're able to pause and respond in a way that really just aligns with how they want to show up as a parent, as a human for their child and for themselves, with just so much more intention rather than getting swept away by old stuff, trauma stuff. It's a really empowering process.
Kind of like, and you get a clean slate to like start almost,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I really do see it as like, it's like, it kind of clears through the muck, the things that kind of block us, the really sticky things that we find triggering. And it really helps us store our experiences in a way that just is so much more workable.
I'm sold. Where do I buy this?
Yeah, you're like, I'm sold.
I'll take one. I'll take 10. How do you find, any clinical psychologist, you just like go on their website and see if they're trained in EMDR specifically?
Yeah, I think to be more direct, EMDRIA, EMDRIA, their website has a directory of clinicians that are trained. If you're going on a directory like Psychology Today, any of these directories, you can actually search by approach, and EMDR is usually always an option to like be able to kind of focus in on folks who are trained in EMDR, because it is an approach that needs more specialized training. Sure. And
it's evidence based. Is it more likely to be covered by insurance? Like, is it easy to go through insurance or not so much?
You know, it's such a complex question, because it just really depends on every person's insurance provider, but in coverage.
But some do.
But I think it's so worthwhile to look into. You know,
that's a good way to say it. Yeah. I so many questions came from that, but I'm going to try to ask one in a way that it can combine all of it. So, first of all, the thing that came to mind was when you're doing this work, when you're going through, I love that it's a bottom-up approach, because a lot of that top-down talking about it, like you said, takes so long, and it is helpful to process, but sometimes I'm not quite, like my therapist will ask me questions and I can tell she's trying to dig to it. And I'm like, I don't know. She's like, and what, why do you think your work? I'm like, I don't know. She goes, well, what do you think your body's getting out of that? I'm like, I don't know these questions. And I feel like she knows the answer. I'm like, just tell me the answer. And so sometimes I get stuck. And so I love these bottom-up approaches. But what it made me think of is when you go through this and it's like you're reprocessing old traumas, are there techniques to make sure that like, as you go through potentially new little traumas, so that you can process it in a way that's more efficient, so you don't have to keep redoing this? Is that question making sense? Where you can sort of prevent the trauma from being traumatic to you in a way that you spend more time processing it in the moment so that it doesn't get to that place.
Okay. So let me make sure that I get that I understand. So you're asking like, so the EMDR, this sort of, it's like out of the moment, like out of the moment stuff, right? Like,
right.
This is the work that you're doing, and this is the work that you're doing to process, to heal, right? To address the triggers. EMDR is totally like bottom up approach, which I really appreciate, and I know my clients do too, because it's like, it's different from talk therapy. Like, there isn't a lot of like back and forth. It's like, what's going on? What are you noticing? Okay, like, let's go with that. And like, so much that you don't have to even say a lot of it. I just want to kind of know if things are moving, you know, and where you're feeling that. And it's, it's beautiful. And then there's other approaches, to beyond EMDR. I utilize a lot of acceptance and commitment therapy, which is in the category of like, you know, cognitive behavioral therapies, evidence, another evidence-based approach, but rather than just restructuring thoughts, it's about, so I'm going to get to your question through this. Whereas CBT, which a lot of people hear about, is really about like restructuring thoughts, stimulus and control, like what was the trigger and how can you reclaim a sense of like, you know, control in that situation, like behavioral activation. But ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, is the goal isn't just reduced symptoms. It's about feeling like you're living in alignment with your values. And it's about relating to your emotions in a new way. The acceptance piece is that like, you're going to get triggered. You're going to feel anxiety sometimes. Like we're wired for these things. Like having a child scream in a public place or at the end of the day when you're just like, oh my gosh, this is like, you know, and you have that thought, life gets harder than this. Like, this is just like brushing your teeth, you know, like, and you feel like that resentment, or you feel just like, you know, you're at the, in those moments, you're going to have, like, it's understandable that you're going to have anxiety or frustration or overwhelm. So rather than like CBT would go the route of like restructuring the thoughts you're having in that moment, right? And, you know, deep breathing, like all those things, like diaphragmatic breathing, all beautiful stuff and works evidence-based. But ACT takes this sort of route of what if in that moment I'm able to pause, and maybe that is through breath, right? Pause, notice the thing that I'm feeling and relate to it in a new way. So rather than trying to like challenge it, fight it, restructure it, like push that feeling, that thought away. What if instead I was like, hey, I'm feeling triggered right now. I'm feeling overwhelmed right now. I'm feeling anxious right now. I'm feeling frustrated right now, angry. Hey, anger. Hey, fear. Hey, overwhelm. I knew you'd show up in this moment. Like, of course you would. Like, this is an overwhelming or, you know, triggering experience. Of course it is. So there's again, like a little bit of compassion there. So you're creating a pause between that trigger, that stimulus, and your reaction, just a little bit of space, maybe through like, just like a deep breath and a like, whew, there's anger, there's frustration. I knew you'd show up here. Of course you would. Like it makes sense. Right. So a lot just happened right there. Mm-hmm. There was mindfulness. There was a pause. There was a regulating breath. There was a, an acceptance of like this part of myself and this compassion, like makes sense, you know, yeah. Like maybe a little mantra, like, they're a good child having a hard time, you know, beautiful, you know, good inside stuff that we may need to remind ourselves of in that moment. And what that does is it allows us to keep from having that emotion jump in the driver's seat. And now we're reacting based on that emotion, right? Like anger jumping in the driver's seat or anxiety jumping in the driver's seat. Or sometimes rather than doing that, we might just like numb out, freeze, avoid, like, and maybe, you know, that's another sort of route we might go. But rather if we do this sort of like pausing and acceptance, compassion stuff and regulating ourselves stuff, what we can do then is ask ourselves in this moment, what is the most important thing to me? Like, what is the thing that I value that can help guide how I'm going to respond right here, right now? And when we're able to access that, then the decisions that we make are going to feel so much more in alignment with like the kind of parent we want to be and how we want to show up for our kids. And it's going to create experiences that can begin to repair and in some cases replace what typically would have been such a intense and traumatic, you know, little T, big T, whatever you want to call it, traumatizing, triggering experience with your child. And it's not to say it's not going to be hard, right? Like it's still going to be hard and you're still going to have those moments where it's hard for you to access that. But to your question of like, what can we do in these moments? I think that if we become aware of what our triggers are And a lot of times we can get there pretty easily because our brain's very hypervigilant of like the sounds, the situations, the tone, right? You might notice it in your body physiologically, the tension in your chest and your stomach, becoming aware. This is mindfulness, becoming aware of those things. And then when you begin to notice those things, pausing, and whether that's through breath and saying, okay, I'm feeling overwhelmed. I'm feeling overstimulated myself. I'm feeling like ragey, frustration. Hey, anger. Hey, anxiety. Hey, overwhelm. Of course you're showing up here. It makes sense. This is an overwhelming, frustrating situation. What's important to me though? What's the value I want to prioritize? Is it presence? Is it safety? Is it security? Is it, is it teamwork? Now, how can I take that value to inform how I respond in this moment? And the regulation that can happen in that space, and then the alignment with what's most important to you, right, in that moment, I think can really support those otherwise very triggering experiences that collectively together, prolonged, continuing to happen, can be really traumatizing for a parent.
I think that's such a good thing to point out to parents, is that like the step one that you mentioned, like I'm all about breaking things down into steps, right? Because if mm-hmm. you're, and for, you know, for us who hear about this a lot through our own profession and researching it and knowing about it, it comes more fluid, especially to Dr. Cassidy, who's mentioning it because she coaches her clients. But if you're new in this, my go-to is breaking things down into steps. And like the first thing she mentioned was pause. So if all you can do for this week, and that feels like too overwhelming to notice what you're feeling and call it out, like step one, practice pausing almost automatically. Make that your automatic reaction to when you're feeling trigger is pause, and see if you can just pause and then do whatever you would normally do for a week or two. And then go back to this episode and listen to the rest of the steps that she mentioned yes. and add that on. That is the Just Right challenge, breaking it down so you don't feel overwhelmed. Because I know yeah. sometimes when I'm learning a new strategy and it has more than one step, I'm like, yep. should I write this down on a flashcard and like look at it in the moment? Because I know yeah. I'm not going to remember that when you have that top of your brain. Totally. But if you can remember, pause, just literally pause your mouth, pause what you're doing. If you remember to take a breath, but that's all you have to worry about for the first time while you're starting it.
I so appreciate that because you're so right. Like in these moments, and like, if you're listening to this podcast episode, you probably listened to a dozen of others, or you've seen a dozen other posts on Instagram that are telling you what to do in these moments. And I think if we're trying to break the cycle of like continuously adding more, like that I talked about earlier, like your brain getting like overwhelmed with like little paper cuts every day. Like if we're going to break the cycle and give your brain a margin to process, right? Like what it's experiencing so that it doesn't get stored in this way that kind of elicits this like very triggered traumatic response, is we need to create that space between the trigger and the reaction and the response. And we can do that through pausing. If people do then come back to this episode once they practice the pause and they want something that feels a little bit easier to remember in terms of steps, I know that you love acronyms, mnemonics. I always forget like what to call it, but BOLD, B-O-L-D, breathe, which is the pause. O, which is like observe, which is the, all right, what am I feeling here? Like what's getting triggered
so
here?
Observe like internally, right? Not like observe environmentally.
Yeah. Observe internally.
Observe in your body. Okay.
Yeah. Listen, L is listen to your values, and then D is decide on action. So that's B-O-L-D, be bold, super cheesy.
I love that.
You need the cheese. You need the cheesiness.
So find where you're currently at. If you are really good at pausing, but then you get stuck and you don't know what to do next, then come back and do the O and just add on from there. I love that.
Yeah.
I have a couple more questions for you before we sign off here. So another big thing that I was thinking of when we were talking about the different kinds of trauma and how you can witness it, are there brains that are more prone to seeing something and then storing that as a trauma? Like I'm thinking of like my husband and I both witnessed the same meltdowns, the same period, mm-hmm. the same everything, but like he is far, far, far away from me in the mm-hmm. spectrum of anxiety and trauma than I am. And so I'm sure there are other people out there who have the same case where like two people, more than one person experience the same thing, but only one walks away with these feelings of PTSD or trauma and all of that.
Absolutely. So what is that? And this can relate to like all sorts of experiences, right? Like a birth experience, a feeding journey, right? Like you both may have experienced something very similar and walk away feeling differently, impacted in different ways by that. Mm-hmm. And I think that what we're looking at there is the whole picture and context. And so your question was like, are there different brains? Are some brains more like, and it's like,
well, to it. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think it's like, we got to look at the brain in all the experiences and all the wiring that that brain has that came into that moment and that experience. Right. And so what are some of the factors that can impact how we experience these things differently? Our past, our own childhoods, right? Like, our other outside of childhood, like our other, you know, experiences that we've had that connect to any element of that experience. And obviously, as we're talking about here, and I know the work that you do so well is not all of our brains experience the world in the same way, right? Even outside of experience, even outside of like what we've walked through and experienced throughout our lifetime. And so, for instance, like my husband and I, like we have different childhoods, different upbringings. We brought different ideas about who we are, what feels safe, what to expect out of a relationship. We brought all of that into our marriage and into our family. And my husband also brought into these moments, like his neurodivergent brain, you know, that like experiences the world around him in a different way. The way that he experiences sound and smell and touch is very different from how I do, I've learned. And so, you know, a lot of parenting, you know, elements of sound and of touch and of smells come into play. And so all of that matters when you look at how we experience these things differently. And I think the more and more that we can gain insight into ourselves, just like I said earlier, like how I shifted things to understand my child's diagnosis, I got to know my child more intimately. I really see the work that I do, because I work primarily with adults and parents, and I really see my job is supporting that person to get to know themselves more intimately, to get to know, you know, how their past experiences show up in their present day experiences, how their brains sort of make sense of the world around them, whether that's because they're predisposed to anxiety or sensory overload, right? Like, I think it's just the more we can more intimately know ourselves, then the easier it is for us to make sense of why certain things are going to be triggering for us, and to care for ourselves so that we can show up in alignment with our values and the way in which we want to be parenting.
That makes so much sense, because yes, my brain is, I have anxiety. And so my brain processes things differently. So I probably go into fight or flight much quicker than my husband does. So those meltdowns definitely were like happening often and triggering that. So thank you for that. And then my last question was, you kind of touched on it earlier. You mentioned feelings of like resentment that come up with PTSD. Mm-hmm. So I had a lot of people ask how resentment fits into this picture with trauma, and how to let go of it. So as you were kind of mentioning, we were talking about ACT and accepting it. I'm wondering if you also can put that into the picture of like, oh, hi, resentment, and calling that out as something to accept. And also if there's other ways and strategies that you can think of resentment and any other things you want to tie up with that and how it relates to trauma.
And let me just make the acceptance piece so super duper clear. So like, because sometimes people are like, so is this just like acceptance? Like, well, whatever, take the wheels, you know, resentment. Like, it's just like, I give up. Like, and it's not it at all. It's actually very, very, very opposite. opposite of that. Like, it's acceptance to the fact that, like, you are a human being wired for feelings and emotions. Like, anxiety ain't going anywhere. I don't want it to go anywhere, because if I have no anxiety, like, I'm not going to be safe. I'm not going to be able to focus when, like, I'm not going to prioritize the things that are most important. Like, mm-hmm. a certain level of anxiety can actually be really helpful and be very quite productive. And I think that, so the acceptance is really about accepting the fact that we're human beings that are wired for emotions. The emotions are going to show up. Instead of fighting them, instead of avoiding or numbing from them and pretending like they're not there, white knuckling through it, rather we're going to turn towards it and say, hey, here's this thing I'm feeling. Like, let's look to see why. Okay, makes sense. I can have some compassion for myself now. And I think the same goes for resentment, right? I think I really understand resentment in what we're talking about here in parenting as like, oh my gosh, like I'm trying to like do the work, or I want to be a good parent. And when I, especially parenting a neurodivergent child, it's so much more often than not, you're going to have a hard day, right? And like the things are going to be more challenging, and the mental load, the emotional load, it's heavy. And so you can have moments of feeling like resentful that it is so difficult, that these moments with your child are so difficult, and that you can feel resentful that you don't get to experience certain things that another family and another child might experience because their child isn't neurodivergent. And so that resentment can pop up, and then oof, what follows that? Hey, guilt. Hey, shame. Welcome to the party. Like, and what I would say to that is, I understand. It makes sense that you would show up here because I was having feelings of resentment. I think that how I might meet the resentment is honestly with compassion. With compassion and understanding that like it makes sense, because it's understandable that as a parent, I had these certain ideas or expectations of what this was going to look like, and it looks different, and this is hard. And the guilt and the shame, like the antidote to shame is connection. So getting support, finding other people who get it, right? Like talking to other parents who have neurodivergent children, because oh my gosh, can they be life-giving to know that you're not alone? I really think it's in the like aloneness that we can really, really get into a dark place, and that resentment and that shame can just fester and grow. And then, yeah, I think that it'd be meeting that resentment with like compassion. If it's followed up by shame, knowing that the antidote to shame oftentimes is connection, vulnerability with the people who've earned the right to be a witness to these parts of ourselves. And hopefully in the context of that relationship, also being reminded that you feel resentful because this isn't what you expected, and this is hard, and you're not alone, and you can then, with that space and that pause that was created, and just relating to that resentment in that way rather than just spiraling into shame, find a way to respond to your child and to the situation so that you can keep showing up as the type of parent that you want to be, to create the most opportunities for connection with your child. And that might look like asking for breaks, setting better boundaries, tapping out, tapping in, communicating with your partner what you're needing. Those are just some examples of what that could look like. But I hope that answered your question.
Yes, that was such a good answer. And that ties it up so nicely. Thank you so much for being here. I feel healed. Personally feel healed already just from this conversation. And I think we're going to crash the EMDR IA Andrea website. Anybody who's listening is going to go search for a provider right now. I know I'm going to do that next. But Cassidy, can you tell everybody where we can find you if we want to learn more from you, what resources you have to parents? You have so much stuff going on. You have resources for therapists, but also a lot of really great stuff for parents. So please let us know where we can find you and what other goodies and resources we have so we can continue learning from you.
Yes. So you can find me on Instagram. That's where you and I met. And so that's a great place to start. I'm at Dr. Cassidy on Instagram. I have a private practice based in California, so able to see anyone who resides in California. I am trained in EMDR, as is the other therapist that works for me in my practice. So we both take a very similar approach and work with a lot of parents of young children or folks navigating, you know, fertility, pregnancy, and postpartum and early parenthood. I also, as you said, have resources for therapists. So I have another account, Holding Space for Therapists, another podcast called Holding Space for Therapists. I don't know if I mentioned I have a podcast called Holding Space for Parents as well, which is what you were on. And over there, I share resources for being a mom and business owner. So talk about private practice and marketing and all that cool stuff. So really a lot of support for building a modern private practice so that you can reach those folks that are out there looking for a therapist just like you. And yeah, so drcastymft.com is my website. That's where you can learn more about my private practice, and has a great link to visit because it has all the things. Instagram links, has the podcast links, and courses for therapists and resources.
Awesome. I will put all of those links in the show notes. Thank you again for being here. Thank you everyone for listening. And we will talk soon.
Bye. Thank you so much for having me. It was so fun.
Yay. Okay. We'll talk soon.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider rating it and leaving a review, which helps other parents find me as well. Want to learn more from me? I share tons more over on Instagram @TheOTButterfly. See you next time.